doubts cannot be healed just by hurling, you know, arguments at people. Literature and the arts, again, is important here because our desires, our emotions are shaped by those sorts of things. What we take to be beautiful, what we take to be good, what we take to be meaningful affects our desires and our hopes and our fears. And that's the soil from which belief ultimately springs. It's not just a product of sort of rational argument or even sort of a quote evidence that demands a verdict. We're more complicated than that.
I'm speaking today with Joshua M. McNall, Associate Professor of Pastoral Theology and Church Relations Ambassador at Oklahoma Wesleyan University. He's the author of several articles and four books, including one we're discussing today that was published just last year. That book is titled, Perhaps, Reclaiming the Space Between Doubt and Dogmatism, a compelling look at the role of the imagination in helping us negotiate religious complexity and connect more fully with the things of God. I'm Matthew Wickman, Founding Director of the BYU Humanities Center.
All right, I'll begin this morning with an apology. I don't have our fancy sound equipment this morning because I'm here at home and not at school because it snowed last night and we're recording in the early morning. And so the roads are kind of icy. So I thought, you know what, we'll stay here. But fortunately, Josh McNall has a nice microphone where he is. So he'll sound better than I do, which is no surprise. Josh, good morning. It's great to see you. Thank you very much.
That's great to see you. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, it's a delight. I love your book we're talking about today, this book, Perhaps. And I've got all kinds of questions to ask you about it. First, you know, I begin by asking my guests how about the role that faith plays in their life and their work. And that's kind of a complicated question in your case for at least two reasons, right? I mean, first, the book we'll be discussing today is largely about imagination as a kind of a supplement to faith. And second, faith, as you describe it in the book, and I really appreciate this, it's a nuanced concept. It isn't simply a matter of belief, but also a matter of loyalty, trust, you know, faithfulness to something or someone. So with these two caveats, my question may be a little naive, but I'll ask it anyway, and we'll see how you frame it. How does faith play into your life and work?
Well, it's played in, you know, probably in innumerable ways from before I can even remember. I grew up in a pastor's home in rural Kansas, so smack dab in the middle of the United States. And from before I could even remember was, you know, going to the church services, was, you know, involved in prayer and things like that. So I think, you know, faith has shaped me from my earliest memories. But like a lot of people, as I grew older and I started to ask bigger questions, I had to sort through whether or not the things maybe I just accepted from my parents or from my tradition were things that I, you know, still believe for myself. And so there was definitely a period, probably like for most people, where I had to begin to sort through those faith questions in a deeper way, around about the time of college, remained a person of faith, but you know, there was certainly a season of having to kind of ask myself if I really belonged in a faith community and sort of mature in my faith through those years.
Yeah, okay, that rings true to me too. I've certainly been through that myself. I also have a lot of people, right, who kind of make it past those years, late teens into the 20s. You kind of come of age. Are you better for having gone through that kind of process of serious evaluation?
Yeah, I think so. I think that in some cases, and I write about this in the book, that going through a season of trial or even a season of doubt can be a process that God uses to refine our faith, you know, just as fire can refine metals. And so I think I am better for it. I wouldn't say, people often use the phrase, you know, it's important to make your faith your own. And I think that in some ways that's true, but in other ways, you don't want to make your faith your own because faith is something that's meant to grow in a community and in relationships. It's never an individualistic possession. And so I think that God has used those seasons in my life to hopefully mature my faith through certain doubts, questions, and even trials.
What a nice insight into not simply making faith your own. I think that's really profound. It reminds me of the Christ's adage, right? Those who lose their lives will find them. You know, mm-hmm. You lose your lives, you know, life in a faith community, you find it back. You find an authenticity you might not have realized was there otherwise. Yeah. Thank you for that. We'll get into some of the details of your new book, perhaps. But maybe, you know, perhaps we can begin by sketching its general argument. You propose that the concept, perhaps, can help us, I'm quoting you here, reclaim the space between doubt and dogmatism. It's a provocative phrase, Josh. Can you give us a brief overview of what you mean by that?
Yeah, those two poles or those two extremes, I talk about them under the labels of doubt and dogmatism. But I think maybe even more broadly than that, most of our listeners can maybe relate to the fact that our cultures increasingly feel sometimes like they're being sort of dominated or even terrorized by the fringes, sort of the loudest voices on any particular issue that we're talking about. It doesn't really matter which one, but it's kind of being dominated by the fringes. And that's driven by algorithms sometimes that prioritize whatever generates outrage or engagement. But the two extremes that I'm talking about are what I would define as a kind of pervasive skepticism. And that's what I mean by doubt. I don't mean honest questions. I mean this sort of crippling doubt. And then on the other extreme, an increasingly abrasive claim to certainty, often coming from certain segments of religion, right? So on the one side, we might locate sort of like the new atheists as sort of pervasive skepticism. And on the other extreme, we might locate certain forms of kind of fundamentalism as a sort of abrasive claim to certitude. That's really what I mean by those two extremes on questions of God and faith, doubt and dogmatism.
Yeah, okay. I like that a lot. You mentioned certitude, and I like the distinction you do there between kind of the new atheists on one end and kind of fundamentalism on the other end. I got to say, though, those categories start to bleed together for me. I hear lots of what you called abrasive certainty and the part of those that say, well, I don't believe in God, I believe in science. You know, and so that led to certainty, which I find, I mean, I love science. I'm all for it, right? You know, but it certainly is a discipline that actually leads to big questions and not necessarily certitudes in its own right.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I talk in the book about how the categories do bleed together in certain instances where a certain form of doubt becomes its own dogmatism. It becomes its own form of fundamentalism. And I think I talk about this as well. Our opponents tend to rub off on us sometimes, whether we're talking about the way they frame their arguments or even their tone. We tend to sort of be conformed to the image sometimes of those we despise. And that's almost always a bad thing. And in those cases, I think you're right, that doubt and dogmatism sort of slide together in certain instances.
Yeah, right. So let me, you write in the book about something that I find really provocative. You write that that this idea of the perhaps involves a kind of a faith-seeking imagination. That's your phrase. I love that phrase. And you discuss elsewhere that this turns you in the direction of literature. Now, this piques the interest of a literature professor like me, right? I'm a literature geek, so I think that's really great. And the appeal to imagination fits with the title of this podcast, right? Faith and Imagination. Now, you state, this is quoting you, you state that imagination, quote, is essential, especially in a climate of polarization and partisan infighting. All right, so a couple of questions here. First, what do you mean by faith-seeking imagination?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, that phrase, faith-seeking understanding, is kind of the more commonly used version of it, and it comes from the Middle Ages. A guy named Anselm of Canterbury said that's the posture we should have with regard to our religious life. We should start from a position of trust or faith, and then we should seek more understanding. And so I agree with that. I think that's a great posture to have in life, but what I mean by faith-seeking imagination is I think sometimes, especially in seasons of trial or doubt or uncertainty, or in a culture of just sort of polarization, what we need is a reinvigorated imagination to move past the sort of the warring extremes or options that have been presented to us, and to say, well, what if there's another option here besides these sort of equally unsavory extremes? And that involves this active process of saying, what if? To sort of, you know, to quote Emily Dickinson's famous poem, we need to dwell in possibility. And I think that posture of possibility is the space of imagination. And what I'd like to do is to marry it together with an attitude of faith that is open to spiritual things, that is open to the healing work of God in our culture, but more than that, in our own lives.
Yeah, I think that's such a it's such an elegant way of approaching faith, Josh. And it's really, it seems to me to have both, sort of possibility in that, Dickinsonian sense. But also it seems like a good gesture of healing for a culture like ours, which is so sort of fraught with false certainty or extreme unknowing. I love what you're describing. Let me dig into that a little bit about your appeal to literature and imagination in these evocative ways. In your wider religious community, do you find that people are suspicious of literature? I mean, either because literature is merely a product of the imagination, that it articulates fantasies and therefore muddies our belief in real things, or that, you know, it's just kind of like, kind of a frou-frou, you know, that it doesn't have substance, that it's not real work in the world and therefore is a diversion from things that should merit our attention and our study. Do you find that literature is given the kind of respect that it merits, or that it itself is a source of skepticism?
I think it's a great question. I think it really depends on the group that you're talking about. I've seen some statistics recently on even like gender differences in terms of who reads fiction versus nonfiction, and that male audiences are much less likely to read fiction. They tend to gravitate towards nonfiction, which is as a male who loves fiction, you know, I would love to see that reversed, because I think there's profound value in literature of all sorts. I do think in some cases, the type of literature that even fiction readers gravitate towards is not always the most substantive, you know, and I'm all for reading all different kinds of books, not just classics, not just, you know, but I think there's a real value in great works of art to point us toward transcendent beauty, truth, and goodness. And so I think therein lies the value of literature, even beyond disciplines that we might associate with literature or fiction. So I'm a theologian. I joke around in the acknowledgments that really I want to teach lit classes. I love fiction, but you know, so now I've written some fiction in this book through a little narrative that weaves through, and I'm trying to get my provost or my assistant provost to let me sit in on some more literature classes now.
That's great. I love it. It's funny. Just this morning, I was emailing a former student of mine who's a very good friend, and she's currently getting a degree at Yale Divinity School. And I was telling her, if I had time enough and world enough in time, I would love to get an advanced degree in theology. So here you are, the theologian that wants a literature degree, and I'm the literature guy that'd like a degree in theology. So we could trade places, Josh, right? This might be mutually beneficial, right?
That sounds great.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let me ask you one more question about this line of conversation. You write that, and I'm quoting you again here, imaginative storytelling can unearth realities that cannot be fully appreciated by detached analysis. Now, I wholly agree with that statement, but what do you say to people who complain that such storytelling undercuts belief in biblical narratives as historical phenomena, right? Yeah. That projecting too much imagination into scripture undercuts our ability to believe in it fully. How do you walk that line?
Yeah, well, I think, I like to quote Karl Barth, who supposedly said, the answer is Jesus, now what's the question? So as a theologian, that's kind of my go-to response. The answer is always Jesus. But in this case, my answer really would be Jesus, because when Jesus engages with a whole variety of audiences, not just learned intellectuals, but fishermen and prostitutes and tax collectors and just regular people on the street, his go-to method for teaching truths about God and the kingdom of God is to create short fictional stories that have this incredible power both to soften and to harden the audience that hears them. And so Jesus is a crafter of fiction to teach truths about himself and about the kingdom of God. And so I guess maybe the simplest answer is I'm just trying to be like Jesus in that way.
That's a great answer. I really like that. And also that's provocative, you say, both to soften and harden. Yeah, because those short fictional narratives, those parables, for example, those really can cut in both directions.
Yeah, and I think you see that in the way Jesus often ends his parables, where he says, if you have ears to hear, then hear. And it's a sort of a strange statement, especially for modern people, because you're thinking, well, you know, who doesn't have ears? You know, what's he talking about? But I think he's talking about this thing that's woven all the way through the scriptures, that you start to become like whatever it is you worship. And if you are worshiping gods of wood and stone that are hard, then your own heart starts to become hardened to the things of God, and your own ears, you know, idols still have ears in some cases, you know, calves and whatnot, but they no longer hear. And so I think the function of the parable sometimes depends on the heart of the hearer, whether or not they actually are hardened by those fictional stories or softened by them. And that's the power of fiction. And I think also kind of one of the mysteries of God's work in the world.
Very well said. Thank you. Now let's talk a bit about doubt and dogmatism, these two poles, right, you discuss in the book. You remark that doubt is a topic that seems to be in vogue today. I very much agree with that statement. And that there's a difference between healthy and unhealthy doubt. You touched on this earlier, but how would you understand or describe that difference between the healthy doubt on the one hand and the unhealthy on the other?
Yeah, I think sometimes in certain religious communities, and maybe even in some of the kinds of traditions that I, you know, am rooted in, like the evangelical tradition, it was sort of taboo to admit that you were struggling with big questions, with doubts, with uncertainty. And in some cases, the result was that people had to sort of hide their doubts. They couldn't talk about them openly. And so in our day and age, where do you go with it? Well, you go to the internet. You YouTube your doubts, you know. And unfortunately, the algorithms that govern that space do not always have your best interest in mind. And so a culture that leads people to sort of deny and repress their doubts sort of tragically ends up fostering all sorts of bigger problems than if we were actually able to talk about them in a culture of respect and trust and empathy. And so when I talk about the extreme of doubt, the first thing that needs to be said is I'm not talking about honest questions. I'm not talking about uncertainty. And I think biblically speaking, when that word is used in the Greek, it's often speaking of what the divided heart, a heart that is divided against itself and trying to pull in two different directions at once, in a lack of allegiance to Christ or the things of God. So it's not a word that's used in the scriptures typically to speak of honest questions or uncertainty. And so that bit of definition is really important, I think, if we're going to talk about doubts today.
You know, I found that in your book really insightful. I love that discussion of doubt, and you're drawing on the etymology there, like in the original, in the Greek, that divided heart. I found that to be really descriptive of what I have felt myself, what I observe, you know, around. And also one more comment on what you just said about turning to the internet, which is so true, right? To find, and you know, the internet, I mean, It's amazing. I'm so grateful it's there. It's also the world's largest trash heap of information. I mean, just, you know, you got to dig through there to kind of find gems sometimes. What makes me kind of sad about people who turn to the internet, as I observe some people that I know and love, students or other loved ones, is that they don't just go there looking for information. They often go there looking for community. And when you can find a community on the internet, I think that's positive, you know. That's, mm-hmm. But the problem is these tend to be very ephemeral communities. You know, they don't have the same kind of enduring sort of status or the kind of emotional depth that you encounter in the communities that you find in a religion, for example, where even if those alongside whom you worship may not have your same attitudes in all things, may not share your politics, may not share your background, you know, may not share your views on all things scriptural, but at the very least, there's a common commitment there, right? In these churches to Christ or to some other, if it's a different religion, some other, you know, sort of manifestation of God. But at least there you have something that's durable in ways that these communities that are internet-formed communities are not. And I worry that those who leave churches and find their people on the web, on the one hand, I'm glad you found some people. On the other hand, you know, talk to me in 5 years about where you are, because those things right there are not as lasting as the kind of things that I see inside of religious communities.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I, you know, obviously we're on the internet right now. We're utilizing it. It's amazing. But I think the two things I would say on that point is, I think if we talk about who we are as humans, that our embodiment is a crucial feature of who we are. And flesh and blood relationships are crucially important. It's not to say you can't have relationships online, but I think a sort of physical presence is, we've seen in the wake of this pandemic, how important that is to be physically present with others. The other thing I would say about the community is that, about the internet, is that the internet allows us to have incredibly niche market communities with people who share all of our niche beliefs and concerns and outrages. And I think there's a great value of being enmeshed in a community that doesn't share all of those things. And actually a community that makes you profoundly uncomfortable at certain points, I think that can be a good thing. And you get that in some of these very strange worshiping communities where we have to sit next to each other, people we don't necessarily agree with, and learn how to love and serve. So I think there's value in those flesh and blood communities.
Yeah, that's well said, Josh. Thank you. I agree. That's my experience. Absolutely. So your book, I've got to say that the book is full of these really clever phrases. You've got a real good sense for a turn of phrase. One of the phrases I love in the book is the phrase cogito ergo none. You know, so playing on the Cartesian cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. In this case here, I think, therefore, I'm a nun. I am perhaps spiritual, but not religious, implying that if one is a rational thinker, a critical thinker, that one can't be religious, which does not seem empirically true at all. But there is a widespread attitude that's the way it is. Do you have a kind of a quick response to that kind of, you know, that kind of attitude?
Yeah, I think maybe the shortest thing I could say there is that there is a sense in which sometimes deconversions are a process of just becoming an intelligent and mature person. And somebody who's written a lot about that is the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor. And he talks about how deconversions on the basis of, quote, I'm using scare quotes here, science, often have less to do with science or actual evidence, and rather more to do with the sense of kind of grown-upness that comes with using that word. And that's a sense in which I think we kind of twist the Cartesian dictum and say, well, I think, therefore, I'm now a nun. You know, I don't belong to any religious group. And it may say more about the psychology of the thinker than about the actual evidence that's being marshaled. And so that's, I appreciate your kind words about my writing. I think that's something that is in play for a lot of people wrestling with doubt and faith and those kinds of things.
Yeah. Here's another phrase of yours I love. survival of the shrillest. you discuss the widespread association of dogmatism, with evangelicalism. And we discussed this morning, it's not just evangelicalism, but it's also often in the kind of the strident anti-religious fervor that one finds also. So you find stridency on all sides, shrillness on all sides. And, I'm wondering about this. I want to ask you about this. In the past decade plus, probably more than that, but especially in the last decade, I've heard, read, observed some real strident pushback against evangelicals for a number of reasons, often rooted in politics, for example. And you find that both within the evangelical community and from outside the community. As you reflect on the really quite shrill reaction against evangelicalism in traditional media and on social media, do you see a difference between the dogmatism of the religion on the one hand, and on the other, the dogmatism that condemns the religion? In other words, is there a difference there that's substantive? And do you see a way out of these shouting matches that we find ourselves in as a society?
It's a great question. I think the two forms of dogmatism are rooted in some of the same human tendencies, and they're driven by some of the same technological forces or algorithms that actually reward outrage and shrillness, drive those voices to the top. And that's what I mean by survival of the shrillest. They actually get bigger platforms and a larger reach. So I think some of the shrillness on both sides, they're driven by some of the same human impulses. One of them is just fear. Fear drives shrillness, a sense that one is losing the battle. And so I heard a professor say at one point that, that yelling or elevation in one's tone is often a sign that someone thinks they're losing the argument. And we become like the proverbial preacher who, writes in the margin of his sermon, logic is weak, comma, yell louder. So that's the common impulse on both the religious and in the anti-religious side. But I think something that I would hope that would be different, and it's not always the case, is that I would hope that the people who claim the name of Jesus would be different, would be marked by other postures. And that's sadly not always the case. So I expect in some ways more from that crowd, my own tribe, for instance, and it's sadly not always true, but I would hope that people who claim the name of Christ and a posture of hope and belief and renewal wouldn't give way to sort of the shrill winds of cultural dogmatism.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I really appreciate that observation of yours. For me, one of the signs of an authentic spiritual life, an authentic connection to Christ, at least in my experience, and I'd love to hear your experience, is that I am rarely allowed to be left in my current state. I often feel that when I feel inspired in some way, it's to be better than I am, to have a more expansive capacity to understand other people or to empathize with them. It's to be maybe it's showing more courage not to speak but to listen better. And I find that God at least rarely leaves me in the place where I'm found. There's always a come this way kind of a thing where I've got to move. And in that respect, I find that kind of approach is not very conducive to the shrillness that I might feel inclined to vent. That I often do vent in the shower as I think about things that make me angry in the world, but that in actuality, in my spiritual life, I think, more is asked of me than that. I can't just settle for that.
Mm. Yeah.
One of your interpretive examples in your book of a biblical figure who learns to speak this language of perhaps is Abraham. Mm. Can you explain how Abraham learns to say that word?
Yeah, it's sort of the biblical case study that begins the book is Genesis chapter 22, and it's a Hebrew word called the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, and it's a horrible story for modern listeners in many cases because here's a father who is told to sacrifice his son, to kill his beloved son, who has been promised and born through great trial. And here Abraham and Sarah are very old, and they've never been able to have a child, and they finally have this son. And then God commands Abraham to sacrifice him. And so that story is often used by folks who are opponents of religion to say, well, I mean, look right here. Here's a great example of how barbaric and terrible and nonsensical the Judeo-Christian heritage is. You know, I think Christopher Hitchens has a nice line, a terrible line, but a nice line where he says, all three monotheisms are rooted or have this story in it where an old man is willing to hear voices that tell him to kill his son and then go and do it. So there you go. There you go. All the, big monotheistic religions are all, kind of off the table. And so I look at that story as a father. I have four little kids. I can't imagine being asked to sacrifice one of my kids. I would have just said no. But I asked the question, well, how was Abraham able to step forward in this radical act of obedience? Thankfully, of course, God does not require sacrifice and teaches that very clearly in the rest of the canon. But so how did he do that? And we don't really hear anything from Abraham on that long, lonely walk. He's silent for the most part. But in the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews, we have this incredible sort of just very short statement in Hebrews chapter 11 that Abraham was willing to obey because he believed that God could even raise the dead, that he could raise Isaac from the dead, which is a radical, strange statement, especially when you think about he's not just, performing CPR on a non-responsive son. He's going to burn him on the altar to ash. Now, who is this God who inspires belief and resurrection even from the ash heap? And I find that passage fascinating, but there's also some logic behind it. I don't agree with Soren Kierkegaard, who claims that faith is only a leap into the darkness. Although I think there's a part of that that's sometimes true. And so the part of the Abraham story I latch onto in Genesis is that this is a man and his wife who had seen this God conquer death not once, but twice in the birth of this son, Isaac. It says that Sarah's womb was dead. It says that Abraham's body was as good as dead. And yet here's this kid. He's right here. He's walking. He's talking. And so I think right there is, in a nutshell, kind of biblical faith. It is a faith in a God who has proven himself trustworthy through history, through previous generations across the centuries, and a God who can even conquer death, the death of the beloved son. And of course, we don't see that in Isaac. Abraham's perhapsing is unnecessary because God doesn't need to raise Isaac from the ash heap. But on the other hand, it's entirely correct because he does raise the beloved son in the form of Jesus Christ from death. And that gives us hope that he can do it for us, for our children, that he can do that again. And so that's sort of a meandering account of that story in both its terror and its the questions that hang over it, but also the sort of logic that runs through it in a God who can raise the dead.
I found it in the book and here on the podcast to be a really compelling reading of that. I really appreciate your insights into that story and the connection to Hebrews, which of course is crucial for Christianity, of those three great monotheisms, right? The Christian tradition that's my own is profound. And I think it's great insight, Josh. You know, that binding of Isaac, that Akedah, occurs on Mount Moriah. And you've got a chapter in your book titled Guardrails on Moriah. And you discuss, ways and reasons when it may not be appropriate to appeal to the idea of perhaps. and you list 10 principles. And I found the list really great. And I wonder if you could discuss just a couple of them here with us. One of them, one of these guardrails is what you say, be clear about the unclear.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I don't want to endorse speculation or perhapsing as a panacea for all of our ills. And there are certainly problematic ways that it can be employed. I call that what-if-ery run amok. So I don't want to engage in unfruitful speculation. So those guardrails, 10 commandments seem like a fitting number. I've heard that number before. So a few of them are just kind of basic, hopefully helpful pieces of advice to use when we engage our imaginations. And so you mentioned, be clear about the unclear. And I think there is a need for us in theology, but just in life, to be very honest about what we don't know, to be, very clear about the parts of life that we are unclear about. And that can provide a nice basis for further inquiry, but it also prevents us from faking certainty as a way of covering over, our own insecurities and things like that. So that's what I mean by be clear about the unclear. And there's several other commands there. One of them I talk about is the need to mean your maybes. So when we say maybe, we need to mean it. We don't want to use perhaps as a way of just floating ideas that we want to get out there, but we don't want to be attached to the sort of like disingenuous, dishonest perhapsing. I talk about the need to not go alone in our perhapsing. We've talked about that previously. You need a community of people around you who can believe for you even when you don't believe yourself. The story in the Gospels of the man's friends who lower him down through the hole in the roof. And it says that when Jesus saw the faith of the man's friends, he said, "Son, your sins are forgiven." And I think all of us need a community around us like that, who can carry us, who can bring us before Jesus, and who can believe even when we don't believe for ourselves. And so that's one of the guardrails as well, the need to not go alone when we are walking this difficult road of faith. So that's just three of them. There's seven more. I probably can't remember all of them. It's been a while since I wrote the book, but that's that chapter.
Yeah, no, it's great. I really appreciated those. They're well said. One of the most compelling points you make, at least for me, a point I'll be thinking about for a long time, and that I've experienced myself, is this one. I'm quoting you here. You write, "A great many of our doubts, beliefs, and intellectual conclusions are affected more by the aesthetic, the embodied, the traumatic, and the emotive than by the rational, the cerebral, and the scientific," close quote. In other words, we're not strictly rational creatures. And when we find ourselves drawn to something or repelled by something, it's usually a composite of associations that compels our response. And that observation seems really crucial to our learning, not only to say, but also to recognize the inevitability of the perhapses of our lives. Can you comment on that idea about how we arrive at these conclusions in this complex way that we do?
Yeah. And I'm borrowing there from some of the work of Jamie Smith, philosopher, and talks about how we tend to be driven by our desires and not just by reason. And we're not brains on sticks. We're not, just intellectual containers in which information just gets dumped and then we shoot out these beliefs or these positions. That often we are rationalizing creatures more than rational creatures. And what I mean by that is we enlist our reason later, after we've already been driven by our guts or by a whole host of other factors, trauma, our history, or I don't know, whatever you had for dinner last night. And I think that's really important for people to realize that doubts cannot be healed just by hurling, arguments at people. If the malady didn't come forth from that soil, it's not going to be healed by, just dumping sort of intellectual fertilizer on top of it. And so I think literature and the arts, again, is important here because our desires, our emotions are shaped by those sorts of things. What we take to be beautiful, what we take to be good, what we take to be meaningful affects our desires and our hopes and our fears. And that's the soil from which belief ultimately springs. It's not just a product of sort of rational argument or even sort of a quote evidence that demands a verdict. It's we're more complicated than that.
Yeah, that's right. You know, Jamie Smith came to BYU a couple of years ago and lectured. He's been before also in the past, but I heard him lecture 2 years ago and he mentioned something really interesting along this line. He said that he converted to Christianity about age 18. I think he was 17 or 18. And he said in the year before that, he was listening compulsively to U2. I think it was the Joshua Tree was just out. And he said that listening to that, that the sound and the lyric and the whole affect of it, he said, gave him kind of the foundation on which to be able to feel Christianity when he converted a year later. And I thought that was such an interesting way of thinking about the ways that we're acted upon things that give us not just a rational argument, but a whole way of feeling the world. Yes. And imagining our way into it so that things can make sense to us, right? I thought that was a great insight of his. I appreciated that.
Yeah, and I think you see that in a lot of people. C.S. Lewis, very famously, through reading the fairy stories, the fiction of George MacDonald, and the influence of Tolkien and the sort of mythology therein, that to imagine a world in which meaning and truth and beauty and goodness can triumph becomes really important for being able to sort of feel your way into Christian life and Christian truth, I think.
Yeah, it's great. So C.S. Lewis, you mentioned Lewis. So toward the end of your book, right, you have these examples, the kind of imaginative engagement that can help us kind of navigate the complicated theological issues. And you have a chapter on science and religion and one on kind of determinism and free will. And then third, you discuss this vision of the afterlife by C.S. Lewis in his book, The Great Divorce. And you explain why you find Lewis's vision, his imaginative vision, kind of more appealing in narrative form than you do in theological form. I thought that was really provocative how you kind of negotiated that. Can you walk us through that?
Sure. I appreciate that. But like you said, the last three chapters are just sort of case studies in perhapsing in Christian imagination, speculation. And so I deal with, as you said, science and sort of some Darwinian questions. I pair that with some Shakespeare. I deal with determinism and free will and kind of pair that with some John Steinbeck. Sounds like I'm doing like a drink menu here or a dinner menu or something. But then the last one is questions about the afterlife and pair that with C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce. And I kind of juxtapose two different attempts to look at the possibility of what sometimes is called postmortem opportunity. And one of them is by C.S. Lewis, the fictional form in The Great Divorce. And another one is by a theologian that sort of with the tools of analytic philosophy and analytic theology tries to arrive at some sort of argument along those lines. And my point is that for me, in some ways, they're arriving at similar conclusions, but the form of fiction and the use of imagination in Lewis seemed profoundly more believable or compelling to me than the analytic philosophical marshaling of sort of evidence. And I'm not meaning to demean the use of analytic philosophy or evidence. I certainly engage in a fair bit of that even in the book itself. But rather, I'm meaning to highlight the power of narrative and storytelling to sort of sketch a world in which certain things seem plausible that sometimes outstrips the power of rational argument. And in some ways that takes us sort of all the way back to Christ, to the question of why did he sketch these fictional stories when he wanted to teach about the kingdom? And so regardless of Lewis's conclusion, whether he's right or wrong, it's the form of his argument that I find so compelling through the use of this imaginative storytelling.
I think that's really great. I love that. It just reminds me of my own studies in literary theory. The idea, I think I read this somewhere, maybe in Walter Benjamin, perhaps, the idea that fiction alone is already a testament to a belief in some world other than and better than the world in which we currently live. That if we were totally satisfied with the world as is, we'd have no need for fiction. That therefore, the very structure of once upon a time is indicative of a native belief of ours in things that are transcendent, which is kind of similar to what you're talking about there with Lewis. I think that's really important as an idea. So we have like a couple more minutes here to talk. And I'm wondering, right? So having thought a lot about speculative, imaginative theology and how it works in your understanding of scripture and things, my question is, I guess as you speculate yourself a little bit, do you feel like your work as a scholar is helping you to become the person that you want to be, right? So given what you study, and just as importantly, given how you study, can you project who you'd like to be in 10 years? Can you speculate or imagine who that person might be?
I certainly could. I'm sure I'd be wrong. I have a long track record of being wrong in all of those things. I love teaching college students, and I'm sure you can relate to that, whether it's at the undergraduate level, whether it's at the graduate level, or even the doctoral level. One of the things I do now that I've just begun this past year is leading our honors program here at Oklahoma Wesleyan, where I work with students who want an interdisciplinary degree that allows them to take courses in the humanities and literature and things like that alongside whatever courses they're taking, maybe for their other major, whether that's business or education or whatever. And I'm increasingly passionate about that kind of education that says we have to train students and we ourselves have to be shaped broadly across different disciplines if we want to live in this increasingly complex world. And just to sort of give a brief story of that, I was talking with a friend of mine recently who he graduated with, I think, an English degree from my school, went off and did a master's degree in Irish literature at Marquette. And that's one of those degrees that people, if you're just talking to people like, what degree, it's going to cost a lot and you're probably not going to make a lot of this, Irish literature, something like that. And he's got on to work at these incredible companies, Facebook, Google, Twitter, startups. And he said, Josh, one of the things that made me sort of stand apart from others is that I hadn't just been trained in tech or coding, that I had learned to think broadly through my love of literature and things like that. And that just aside from like his earning potential or where he's able to get a job, I mean, those things are secondary, but the kind of person that you become when you're shaped broadly by literature, by the humanities, and I would also say by faith, by theology, that life is just fuller. And it's not just a question of what job you can get. It's a question of who you can become. And so to eventually get back to your question, that's kind of what I want to do. I want to live in that space. And it sounds like from what I know of you, that's sort of the space that you live in as well. And that's what I'm passionate about.
I love that. You are preaching to the choir when you say that, Josh. That is a nice note, I think, on which to conclude our conversation. I want to thank you for your really wonderful book. And it's a large-minded, large-souled book. And I'm grateful to have read it and so grateful to you for your time this morning and talking with me. Thank you so much.
That's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for having me on, Matthew.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.